Good morning. It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. Well, Abraham Lincoln is arguably the most famous, revered, and discussed U.S. president. I don't think there's really any question about that. America has a fascination with Lincoln. Did he have a happy childhood? Did he own slaves? Did he seek war with the South? Well, we're going to get answers to some of those questions and some that you might think of as well this hour as we talk with the author of a new book about Abraham Lincoln titled Did Lincoln Own Slaves? And Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln. And we have the author joining us by telephone, and you can too, at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please use 227-2050, and I'm going to suggest that you start calling right away, because I have a hunch a lot of people are going to want to get in on this. We have perhaps the foremost Lincoln scholar of our time with us on the phone to answer your questions. Anything you've ever wanted to know about President Lincoln, you can probably find out by calling in and asking your question, because Jerry Prokopovich has answered thousands of them, literally, sometimes hundreds a day, as he served for 9 years as the Lincoln Scholar at the Lincoln Museum in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's currently the chair of the History Department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina, and is the author of several books, including Did Lincoln Own Slaves? And Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln, which is the book I'm holding in my hand at the moment. And we welcome Jerry Prokopovich once. I can say it once. I'll say it again before the hour is over. Welcome. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, one of the things that a talk show host generally needs to do in preparation for an interview is write a list of questions. But when the book is an entire list of questions on its own, that seems to be less of an issue. So let me ask the most obvious question, not about Lincoln, but about the book itself. First, we'll get that out of the way, and then I'm sure our callers are going to be pouring in here shortly to ask their own questions. Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote it, as you said, because I served as a public historian working in a museum that focused on Lincoln. And over 9 years there, I heard thousands of different questions from everyone, from kindergarten visitors to senior citizens. And what struck me most about these questions over the years was that they were very different from the questions that I would discuss with my professional colleagues at the conferences, the Organization of American Historians, or the Lincoln Forum, or groups like that. There was a separation between what the public wanted to know and what the professional historians were studying. And I think that's symptomatic of the study of history overall in this country, which is a separate issue. But I thought it might be a contribution I could make to try to bridge that gap, at least as far as Abraham Lincoln is concerned, and try to bring a professional historical perspective to some of these questions that deserve to be answered, even though they're being asked by the public rather than by the professors.
Is there how much do we really know for certain about Lincoln's early life, for example? I mean, are there gaps in what we know about him, or do we have a fairly clear map of what his early life was like?
Well, for someone about whom so much has been written, it is interesting what we don't know, and your question points to the exact problem. With Lincoln's early life, before he's 20 years old, we really don't know very much because nobody was keeping track of him at the time. He was just another boy on the frontier, and nobody was writing down his every move. So what we know about Lincoln's early life consists mostly of reminiscent testimony of what people said after Lincoln was gone. Shortly after he was assassinated, Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, went back to New Salem, Illinois, where Lincoln had lived as a young man. Not literally back to New Salem, the town had disappeared, but back to the people he could find who had lived in New Salem with Lincoln, and sent them questionnaires or interviewed them and tried to find out what they knew. And we're indebted to Herndon for doing this project because those memories are really all that we have to go on as to what Lincoln was like as a young man.
There were you address these questions in the book, but there you've been asked questions, and there have been various speculations about, for example, even the legitimacy of Lincoln's birth.
That question gets asked occasionally. You'd hear someone say if it were true or not. That there's a simple answer to that. Yes, Lincoln's parents were married before he was born, before he was conceived. They were married in 1806. We have the Bible that records their wedding date, and we know the minister in Elizabethtown who married them in Kentucky. And we know that Lincoln had an older sister, Sarah, born in 1807, and then Lincoln himself was born in 1809. So there's no remote question about the marriage of Thomas and Nancy Hanks. But people still ask the question. Usually what it's a sort of memory that they're reflecting of an older question, which was Lincoln's mother illegitimate? And people used to worry about that a great deal back in the 1920s.
Yeah, now it's like, okay, you know, so what's the big deal?
Exactly, which is another reason why I wrote the book was I was fascinated by the way questions have changed over time. A question like that of the purported illegitimacy of Lincoln's mother could just exercise scholars back and forth in the 1920s, whereas, as you say, today, we just don't care. On the other hand, there are questions we ask today that would have been unimaginable 50 years ago.
Give me an example.
Well, probably the best-known one, and one that perhaps some listeners are tempted to ask but don't want to fan the flames, is, was Lincoln gay? That's a question that could not conceivably have been brought up in public 50 or 60 or 70 years ago. But by the mid-1990s, it was the most frequently asked question when Lincoln scholars would give speeches, give talks. That's what people wanted to know.
What is there about Lincoln's life that would suggest that he was gay?
Almost nothing. The circumstantial evidence that is most often cited in that case is that he had a close friend, Joshua Speed, with whom he shared a room and a bed when Lincoln lived in Springfield in the late 1830s, early 1840s. And in modern society, if two unmarried males sleep in the same bed, that's fairly substantial evidence that they may also be having an intimate relationship. But that was not the case in the 19th century, when it was a very common practice. Beds were scarce and expensive, and it didn't signify anything in and of itself. So without any further evidence, and there is no further evidence, there's no reason to believe that Lincoln was gay.
Why are we so fascinated with Abraham Lincoln?
He is, on the one hand, obviously a very important figure in American history for his efforts to end slavery and to save the Union. But there are plenty of important figures in American history who don't get 14,000 books written about them, or who don't have rumors like rumors about his
was he gay?
Exactly, the personal rumors don't spread. Back in the good old days when the Weekly World News used to bring us information in the supermarket checkout line, you'd see besides Bigfoot and Elvis, Lincoln would show up every now and then. George Washington didn't. Franklin Roosevelt didn't, but Lincoln did. So your question is a good one. Why do we focus on this particular president? And to give a one-word answer, he's so contradictory. There was so much about him that goes in different directions, that there's something about Lincoln for everyone.
We're talking about the book, Did Lincoln Own Slaves and Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln, with Jerry Prokopovich, who is the author of this book. How appropriate. And we would invite your questions as well. Here are the phone numbers to use, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you are in Milwaukee, please, 227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. What would you like to know about Abraham Lincoln? What would you like cleared up? What are you confused about his life? We have the person here who can answer your question this morning. And, in fact, let's go to the phones. We've already got some people who want to join our discussion. We'll talk first to Lowell, who's calling us from Minneapolis. Good morning, Lowell.
Good morning.
Okay,
question
we can't
concerning Abe Lincoln's ability to deal with his son Todd's death. How did Abe deal with that? How did he himself move?
We're losing you, Lowell, but I think we got the gist of the question. How did Abraham Lincoln deal with the death of his son?
He actually had to deal with the death of two sons. His second boy, Eddie, died around 1850 when he was 3 years old, and that was certainly difficult for the Lincolns. Shortly afterwards, they conceived another child. But I'm guessing the one the caller was inquiring about was Willie, the second youngest Lincoln boy. Willie and Tad were brothers and playmates in the White House in the first year of the Civil War. They carried on interrupting cabinet meetings and burying their soldier doll in the garden and digging him up and just doing all kinds of boy things around the place. And I'm sure they were a source of great pleasure to Lincoln. But then in February 1862, they both became ill. Tad recovered, but Willie did not. And that's one of the remarkable things about Abraham Lincoln, was how he managed to persevere with the death of this really bright, charming boy that everybody liked. Everyone who knew him liked him. Mary Lincoln couldn't cope. She went into deep mourning for a year and never fully recovered her equilibrium. Abraham Lincoln, for a while, every Thursday, the day of the death, would seclude himself and spend the day in mourning. Gradually recovered. But what he was able to do was compartmentalize his grief in a way that I find remarkable. When the boy died, Lincoln went into his secretary, John Nicolay's office, and said, "Well, my boy is gone. He is really gone," and walked out of the room with tears all on his face. But he was able to then put that aside, close that door literally and figuratively, do the work of running the nation, and then once a week give himself over to private grief. And then eventually he was even able to close off that avenue and just focus on what he needed to do. I mean, as a parent, I just can't imagine how he could have carried on in those circumstances, but he did.
Lowell, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take Irene in Algoma next. Irene, good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm wondering how much we know about the early education of Abraham Lincoln. I've heard that he, you know, used the Bible, and I heard he wrote on the back of a shovel with chalk and things like that. But he turned out to be so brilliant.
That's a very good question and a frequently asked one, I will say, both the writing on the shovel question. The short answer to that is he did it once in a while, but he usually had paper and pen. We know this because there are some surviving fragments of Lincoln's schoolwork with his handwriting on it. But there's also testimony that if there was nothing else, he would write on the back of a flat wooden spade and scrape it off afterward after doing his problems. But his education formally was quite limited. He had about a year and a half of schooling whenever there was a schoolmaster passing through to set up a temporary school and the chores weren't too pressing. Lincoln could get away and go to classes. It added up to what today would be the equivalent of a sixth-grade education. If you look at the kinds of problems on Lincoln's schoolwork, that's about the level he got to, which was about average, actually, for an American, certainly on the frontier in that era. But what is, again, remarkable about him is, as Irene said, that he read so much. He did read the Bible. He read Pilgrim's Progress. He read Parson Weems' biography of George Washington. He read whatever books he could get his hands on. And he became a great self-teacher the rest of his life. He taught himself how to be a surveyor, taught himself how to be a lawyer, taught himself geometry. In the Civil War, he checked out a military textbook from the Library of Congress and learned enough about military terminology to communicate with his generals. He was always teaching himself and learning how to deal with things.
Irene, thanks for the call.
To be able to write the Gettysburg Address is amazing.
It is amazing how he was able to do this, to learn to write something like the Gettysburg Address, which is different from anything else in American political writing. It's so short and compact. People memorize it to this day. Yet it was different from any writing in his day and different from any writing in ours. If a modern speaker tried to give a 2-minute speech and then sit down, we would all look at each other and wonder what was going on. Yet Lincoln was able to pull that off.
Other politicians might take note, might save us all a lot of time. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and have some more questions. Phone lines are starting to fill up now, but hang on. There'll be a line for you shortly. Here are the numbers, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, call us on our local number at 227-2050. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. And as I mentioned, I think earlier, Kathleen should be back on the air next Tuesday. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, here's what's coming up next hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller is coming up. A total eclipse of the moon happens tonight. After 11 this morning, Larry Mueller talks about celestial events with Jim Lattice, director of UW Space Place in Madison, and optics expert Tom Hall with Eagle Optics of Middleton. Larry Mueller next hour here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about a book about Abraham Lincoln, a new one. The book is titled, Did Lincoln Own Slaves? And Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln. The author is Jerry Prokopovich, who served for 9 years as the Lincoln Scholar at the Lincoln Museum in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's currently chair of the History Department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. And he's the author of the book under discussion. Here are the phone numbers if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. Let's take a call next from Jim in Green Bay. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, guys. I'm more interested in Mr. Lincoln's genealogy. I think in the 16th and 1700s, there was a Lincoln family in the Northeast. How far back can you go with his parents? I mean, what country did he come from? England, Scotland? That's my first question. The other one was would be his relationship with Hannibal Hamlin.
Two interesting questions. On the genealogy issue, the Lincoln family can be traced back to England. I believe it's six generations back. Samuel Lincoln was the first to immigrate, and there is a marker in England in the area where he came from. Showing the origins of the Lincoln family there. I came to Hingham, Massachusetts originally, so you're right, he was in the Northeast. And the Lincoln family, every generation thereafter, moved either to the South or to the West, eventually to Pennsylvania, from there through Virginia, finally to Kentucky, where Abraham Lincoln was born, and then he moved to Indiana and finally west to Illinois. So the Lincoln family was a sort of microcosm of the European presence in America moving westward across the continent. And you mentioned also Hannibal Hamlin, who was from Maine. He was Lincoln's vice president, first vice president. And he's someone people ask about because you don't learn much about him in history books. There's not a whole lot there. He and Lincoln did not know each other, I believe, until Hamlin was chosen to be Lincoln's vice presidential running mate in 1860, and they were elected together. But Hamlin's purpose was really just to balance out the ticket with an Easterner to go with Lincoln, the Westerner. They did not consult much. Hamlin did not have much of a role in policy. The most telling document in this regard is the one written just after Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in the fall of 1862, and Hamlin wrote him a note congratulating him, saying it was a great act of the age, but prefacing his note with a comment that, I don't know if your secretaries will let this get by for you to actually see it, but I want you to know what I think. So here's the Vice President of the United States, who's not sure he's high enough in the political ladder for the presidential secretaries to even bother letting his notes get through to the president. That's how out of the loop Hannibal Hamlin was, and he was not renominated in 1864.
Jim, thanks for those questions. Let's go next to Scott in Sister Bay. Scott, good morning.
Good morning. I'm more interested in Lincoln, not the facts of his life, but more his interior life. I wonder if he having died just a few days after the end of the war, if he, or actually I guess it was before the end of the war, but in any event, right at the end of the war, if he breathed a sigh of relief seeing that it was about over, and did he feel like he'd actually saved the Union? First off, was he optimistic for the future of the country? And second of all, would you characterize him as an optimist, as a pessimist, as an upbeat person, or as a practical person? I mean, what was his interior or personal philosophy like?
That's a very big question, and a number of books have been written about just that. One of the great Lincoln biographies, possibly the best one-volume biography, is that by David Herbert Donald, published in 1995, simply titled Lincoln. And it's a little controversial because he would answer your question by calling Lincoln a fatalist. And other historians take issue with that to some extent, but most would agree that Lincoln had a strong belief in providence, in fate, that things were going to work out a certain way. And he felt it was his responsibility to play his part to make things happen as they were supposed to. So neither optimism nor pessimism, as much as a sense of there's a purpose in life, and that's an attitude that can be traced all the way back to the Puritans of New England, and in their case and in Lincoln's case, prompted them to work very hard to do what they could to determine what the providential pattern was and to play their role in it. They didn't resign themselves and simply say, what will be, I don't have to do anything. Rather, Lincoln's view was, I don't know what's going to be, but I'm going to do my best to make things work out as he put it, as God gives us to see the right. With whatever limited knowledge we have, let's do our best. Within that, I guess you could call it a sense of optimism. No, that's not the right word. He believed things were going in a certain direction that he could only control to some extent to the best of his ability. So he was neither optimism nor pessimism is quite right, but he had a strong sense of the future and that how things were going to go. I hope
one of the things.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. One of the things that question brought one to my mind as I was reading the book. One of the things that came up is the question of Lincoln's religious beliefs. And I haven't made a study of Lincoln's life and what he thought and so forth. One of the famous Lincoln quotations is something to the effect of the question is not whether God is on our side, but whether we are on God's side. And he did invoke God in a number of instances. What was Lincoln's religious life like? Was he what's the term I'm looking for? Was he a practicing Christian?
Short answer to that is no. He was not, but he was extremely spiritual, extremely religious. He just never joined any particular church, Christian or otherwise. Didn't belong to any denomination. His religion, like his political philosophy, was very much unique to his own study and his own experiences. He clearly believed in some higher power, in God or providence or fate or what you might want to call it, very much a sort of Old Testament God, overlooking everyone, noting the fall of every sparrow, counting the hairs of every head. That was the God of Lincoln's world, the God he speaks of in the second inaugural address, the one who gives us this civil war as punishment for the sin of slavery, the punishment due to both North and South alike for tolerating that institution for so long. That was Lincoln's God. He rarely mentioned Jesus. He rarely spoke of conventional Christianity. His wife, Mary, once said to William Herndon that Mr. Lincoln was not a technical Christian, whatever that might mean. And yet people ask the question frequently, what was Lincoln's religion, hoping the answer will be he belonged to whatever church the questioner belongs to. And this has resulted over the years in many rumors that Lincoln was secretly baptized in the church of your choice, or that he was planning to be baptized in whatever church you want, but then he was assassinated that very weekend. none of the rumors can be substantiated. There's no evidence of any of that that's credible. But Lincoln's religion has become a source of really intense and serious study in the last 10 or 15 years. Alan Gelzo is a pioneer in this direction, taking Lincoln seriously for his religious philosophy as well as his political philosophy.
Let's take a call next from Mary in La Crosse.
Much has been said about his bouts with depression, and I was wondering if anyone has found that Abraham Lincoln was bipolar, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Mary.
Mary, it's a very good question. If you want to pursue it in detail, there's a book called Lincoln's Melancholy by Joshua Wolf Schenck, which studies just that question, and Josh's book is a very good one. I tend to agree with his conclusions to a degree, which are that Lincoln did suffer from what we would today call clinical depression, based on two incidents in his life. One was after the death of Anne Rutledge, a young woman he knew in New Salem, and another was after his friend Joshua Speed moved away from Springfield and Lincoln's engagement to Mary Todd broke up, both happening at the same time. In each case, Lincoln went into an emotional tailspin afterwards. In the latter case, his friends took razors away from him, fearing he might try to kill himself. He wrote, if my gloom were distributed one drop to every member of the human race, there wouldn't be a single smiling face anywhere in the world. He was extremely depressed after those two events. And so there's no question, perhaps more so than they warranted, that he was subject to these occasional fits of depression, at least these two specific ones. Whether he was bipolar in the sense of being subject to this the rest of his life as a chronic ailment, I think is less clear. Schenck would argue that he was. But we see events like the one I mentioned earlier, the death of his son, Willie, that was so devastating, did not cause him to go into his room on a permanent basis to become non-functional. He continued to run the war. He continued to run the country, even with this great personal sadness, even with the deaths of all the thousands of boys on both sides. He continued to function. So I'm not a medical doctor. I can't say more about whether he was literally bipolar, but he certainly had a strong degree of emotional control and understanding of how he felt and how others might feel in the same circumstances, and he was able to function because of that. If you want to really get a sense of how Lincoln understood how depression could feel, you can do no better than to read his beautiful letter to Fanny McCulloch, written in December 1863, to a young girl who was grieving for her father killed in the war. And he says in the letter, "You right now, you feel that you'll never get any better. But if you just realize that you will, that alone will start to bring relief." And these are the words of somebody who has been in a depression and has known that feeling that things will never improve, and has seen that they can, and has triumphed over it.
Mary, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Phil in Hebron, Illinois.
Good morning,
Phil. Good morning.
Excellent show. I have a quick question for you. I've done a little research on this, and I really can't find an answer for myself. I believe Mr. Lincoln had what I'm going to call a valet named Mr. Johnson. He was a black man, and I've read things that hint at the fact that he was much more than a valet, perhaps a confidant, and that he was maybe at Gettysburg, and that he's buried at Arlington. Is any of that true, and how rare would it be for him to be buried at Arlington, being a civilian?
True on all counts, except I don't recall the Arlington one, but it's possible. I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that immediately. But you're absolutely right about William Johnson, who came to the White House with Lincoln as his valet. But when he got there, Johnson had very dark skin, and the other White House servants were of African descent but had lighter skin, and they would not accept Johnson because he was too dark. There was racial prejudice within the African community as well as universally almost throughout the white community in those days. So Lincoln found a different job for Johnson at the Treasury Department not technically on the White House domestic staff, but he still effectively served as Lincoln's valet until, as you correctly point out, he went with Lincoln to Gettysburg in 1863 for the speech, at which time Lincoln was suffering from varioloid, which is a mild version of smallpox. But Johnson also caught the disease, only a more severe case, and died from it. And I regret that I can't answer your question whether he's buried in Arlington or not. It would not surprise me if he were. He was certainly somebody who Lincoln went out of his way to help, spent a lot of time with Lincoln. We can't know what they said in private, what kind of confidences were exchanged. But given the efforts Lincoln went to keep Johnson with him, I think your speculation is probably pretty well-founded, that they must have had at least some kind of relationship.
Do we know that he was always a free black man?
I don't know Johnson's background before coming to Washington. There are some good articles in the Journal of the Abraham Lincoln Association by people like Mike Vorenberg that look at Lincoln's connection with individual African Americans, and that's where I would go to find the next answer to that.
So let's ask the question that is the title of the book. Did Lincoln own slaves?
Well, first and foremost, no, he didn't. He was born in the slave state, but he lived in Indiana, which was a free territory, then became a free state. Then he lived in Illinois, which is a free state. When he moved to Washington as president, he certainly wasn't about to buy a slave. So the answer is no. But I use it as the title of the book because people do ask the question, even though anyone with even a moderate interest in Lincoln quickly learns the answer is no. That question survives. And I think the reason it does is that it reflects partly a social trend in our time to be skeptical of heroes. And so logically we feel if Washington was a slave owner and Jefferson was a slave owner, then Lincoln must have been a slave owner too, even though it's not true. And there's also the sense, perhaps even more important, that there are people who don't like Abraham Lincoln and attack him for one reason or another. And if they're going to attack him, they have to come to grips with the fact that he helped end slavery, which nobody would deny was a good thing. So they try to disassociate him from it and try to associate him with the universal racism of his era and insinuate that he must have partaken of it. Maybe he even owned slaves. And suddenly the question's out there and floating around. And I heard the question asked, and even though it's not a strong historical question, it needs to be answered. It needs to be answered no, so that people can understand who Lincoln was and why we think the things we do about him.
We're talking about the book, Did Lincoln Own Slaves and Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln, with its author, Jerry Prokopovich. And you can join our question-asking hour as well by calling us at 800-486-8655. Toll-free in Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, after one on Talk of the Nation, guest host Lynn Neary and political junkie Ken Rudin have results of Tuesday's primaries and caucus, plus the use of rhetoric in politics. Ask not what you can do for your political junkie. That's after one this afternoon on Talk of the Nation here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Abraham Lincoln, the subject of this hour and a new book titled Did Lincoln Own Slaves and Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln, written by Jerry Prokopovich, who served for 9 years as the Lincoln Scholar at the Lincoln Museum in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's currently chair of the History Department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. And the format of the book is literally, it's a frequently asked questions list that extends for several hundred pages. And it's organized by the various periods of Lincoln's life. And it pretty much runs the gamut. We have full phone lines, so I want to get back to the callers as soon as possible. But I did want to ask one more question of my own. We'll call it host's privilege. and that is, what's the oddest question you've ever been asked about Abraham Lincoln?
That is a good one.
That may qualify as the oddest question.
That's it right there, yes.
Okay, we'll move on then.
Okay.
Okay, you know, I try. Anyway, let's go back to the phones, and the host won't ask any more questions because clearly that's a job for our callers. Let's go to Scott in Prairie du Chien.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I've always been impressed with how perceptive a president Lincoln was and just how far-sighted he was. And so my question is this. I've just been curious, when Lincoln actually required all the states that had not seceded to furnish troops to quell the rebellion, did he not have a sense of what that would mean in terms of pushing states like Virginia, North Carolina, Arkansas, and so forth, you know, over to the Confederacy? It just strikes me as unusual and curious that he would not have detected this ahead of time. So I've always wondered, did he have some sort of ulterior motive that might involve, you know, an expanded conflict just to, you know, bring in the middle states at that point as well? And thank you, and I'll listen now.
Scott, that's a really good question, because Lincoln was very perceptive, as you say, and could usually have a sense of how events would develop. But in 1861, when Fort Sumter was fired upon, Lincoln's response was to call out 75,000 troops, the most he could do under law at the time, from the other states to suppress what he called combinations too great to be suppressed by the ordinary processes of law and order. The marshal couldn't arrest them, he meant. Now, I think he did miscalculate. As you point out, the response to this was to this call for troops was to cause four additional southern states, Tennessee, Virginia, Arkansas, North Carolina, to withdraw from the Union and join the Confederacy, and that did expand the scope of the conflict. I am as certain as I could be about anything for which there's no document that Lincoln did not intend that result and did not want to expand the scope. Lincoln did miscalculate the depth of secession sentiment in 1861. He was convinced of the basic loyalty of the American people. And when Fort Sumter was fired upon, when South Carolinians began shooting at American soldiers and the American flag, the North rallied the way in our time we remember the nation rallying in 2001 against a foreign enemy. Regardless of politics, regardless of region, everybody was on the same page that in September 2001. And so it was throughout the North, and I think Lincoln believed it would be so in the upper states as well. He conceived of the rebellion as the product of a few leaders, a few people who had deluded the basically loyal Southern public into following them into this mad experiment in rebellion. And if there were just some firmness at the top, the basic loyalty of the Southern people would reassert itself. They would give up this idea and come back to the Union. Lincoln believed that through 1861, even maybe into 1862, and many Northerners did too. Grant wrote that it was only after Shiloh, 10,000 casualties in 2 days, that he realized this was going to be a long war. These Southern people were in earnest, not just the leaders, but the rank and file. So I don't think Lincoln intended to push Southern states into rebellion. I think he was not fully aware of how deep the rebellion spirit ran, and it took him some time to be disillusioned of that.
Thanks for the call, Scott. Let's go next to Bob in Darlington.
Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Morning, Jerry.
Good morning.
My question is, how did Lincoln come to pick Andrew Johnson as his vice president?
Now, that's a question historians don't necessarily agree on. I don't agree with the mainstream view, so I'll tell you what they both are. In 1864, Lincoln ran for re-election. The Republican Party that year renamed itself the Union Party and was in a union with the War Democrats, those Democrats who supported the war. So Lincoln technically ran as the Union candidate, not the Republican candidate. And the Union Party convention in Baltimore, chose Lincoln. He did not attend it, but they chose him in absentia. And then they chose Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, the only senator from a Confederate state who didn't secede when his state seceded, but who stayed in Washington and represented loyal Unionists in his state. It made perfect sense. Johnson represented Lincoln's idea that the South had never legally seceded, and that most Southerners were basically loyal. Johnson was a Democrat. Lincoln was a Republican. That was a good balance. There were all kinds of reasons why Johnson was much more helpful than Hannibal Hamlin as a political symbol.
Why was he impeached?
Well, just to conclude, the problem is there's no way of knowing who put Johnson on the ticket. Most historians think that Lincoln had little to do with it because there's no document showing Lincoln said, get Hamlin out, get Johnson in. But I can't believe anything happened in the Lincoln White House that he didn't have his fingers on, and that somewhere there's a document that his secretaries burned or otherwise disposed of that required it. Now, as to why Johnson was impeached later, this is one of the biggest misconceptions in all American history. It's been cleared up and it's taught differently now, but when I was younger, and I guess most people listening to the show when we were all younger, we were taught the Gone with the Wind version of Reconstruction, that Reconstruction was a terrible time, the South suffered badly. Noble Andrew Johnson tried to carry on Lincoln's kindly policies, but those evil radical Republicans in Congress wouldn't let him do so. That's the traditional view, but Eric Foner and others have shown that the harsh thing about Reconstruction, from the view of those complaining about it, was that black citizens could vote. And it was black voting that the South got rid of with the Jim Crow laws in the late 19th century, and that was the end of Reconstruction and the redeeming of the South when white governments took over, disenfranchised African Americans eventually, and created the Jim Crow system. So Andrew Johnson was impeached in part because he did not cooperate with the Republicans in Congress who were determined to create a two-party system in the South, Republicans and Democrats, which meant you had to have black voting because there weren't that many white Republicans in the South. Johnson, as a Democrat, didn't care if there was a Republican Party in the South. He was happy to have it be a one-party, one-race region, and resisted the Republicans politically, and they eventually impeached him for violating a law. He did violate the law, but the law was probably unconstitutional, so you can argue it either way. He was not convicted. He fell one vote short of conviction, so he stayed in office. But he represented a attempt to reconstruct the South on the pre-war basis by reestablishing the old white power structure. I'm confident that Lincoln, had he survived, would not have tolerated that.
Thanks for the call, Bob. There's an interesting section in your book that talks about Lincoln's views on the relationship between race and slavery. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, Lincoln... People often accuse Lincoln today they accuse him of being a typical white male racist of the 19th century. And Lincoln was certainly a product of his times. He was not, if you read everything he wrote, there are some things you can take out of context that make him appear more racist than any mainstream politician would admit to today. But that's only if you take them out of context. If you read them in context, compared to what, say, Stephen Douglas was saying in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Douglas's racism is wildly over the top. As he insults black people and says this is a country for white people, and compares black people to animals, and it just uses the N-word repeatedly. It's really shocking. And in comparison, Lincoln says a few things to his white racist audience that we find perhaps unacceptable, but are not anything like what others were saying in his day. Lincoln believed slavery was wrong abstractly and thought that Douglas's race baiting was a way to distract the public. Lincoln used all kinds of arguments against slavery, like logic. He once wrote, if A can enslave B, why cannot B enslave A? Because his skin is darker? Then take care, you can be a slave to the next man you meet with a fairer skin than your own. No, because A is smarter than B, then you can be a slave to the next man you meet smarter than you. Because it's in A's interest to enslave B, then why is it not in B's interest to enslave A? In other words, he shows there is nothing underlying slavery other than raw power. The white race in the South had the raw military, physical power to oppress another race, to they had the legal and military means to do it, and they did it. And there was nothing justifying it other than that. And Lincoln felt all the arguments about race, as he once put it, we need to discard all this quibbling about this man, this race and that race being superior or inferior. We need to discard all that and return to the words of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. That was what Lincoln underneath was trying to do, was to get beyond this racial baiting and look at the fundamental injustice of slavery and put it behind us.
Let's take a call from Edith in Waukesha. Edith, good morning.
Good morning. I would be interested to know if you could shed some light on about what happened to President Lincoln's descendants, and are there any descendants who are still alive?
No, there aren't. Maybe. The last known descendant died in 1985. Lincoln had four boys. One died early, then Willie died during the war. Tad died at the age of 17 shortly after the war. Only Robert lived to adulthood. He had three children, one of whom died at an early age. And one of Robert's daughters had two children. So that would be Lincoln's great-grandchildren. They were the ones who lived the longest. Peggy, the great-granddaughter, never married. And Robert Lincoln Beckwith lived on till the 1980s. He did not have any acknowledged children, but in his later years, in his 60s, his housekeeper had a baby, which she claimed was his, which he denied, partly on the grounds that he'd had a vasectomy several years earlier. And the argument was never settled officially, whether the baby is a Lincoln or not. But the case was settled out of court. The child renounced any claim to the Lincoln estate, which was quite large by that time. So legally speaking, there are no Lincolns left.
Thanks for that call, Edith. Let's take a quick call from Cindy in Lake Geneva.
Good morning. Your earlier comment about logic and Lincoln's reasoning ability is a nice segue into my question, which was whether you could comment on how his training and experiences as a lawyer affected him as president, either in his negotiating skills, worldview, whatever you think might be relevant there.
Cindy, it's a great question. I think his training helped him a lot, and I'm biased myself as a recovering lawyer, now a professional historian. But my training as a lawyer helped me with whatever skills I have as a historian, because the law does teach you to think rigorously and logically. It also, in Lincoln's case, exposed him to people all over the state of Illinois in all kinds of situations. And he met and dealt with people in every form of the human condition. So he was very sympathetic and aware of how things worked. He also was very much interested in using his position as a lawyer as a peacemaker. He said this in a speech he once wrote for law students. The lawyer has a superior opportunity to be a good man. It's don't drum up litigation. There'll be plenty of trouble already, but go out and solve problems and be a peacemaker, establish your reputation, and you'll still have plenty of business. And Lincoln was able to do that as a negotiator, as a person who understood what made people tick. So I think his law training and his legal experience was extremely formative in the kind of president he was.
Thanks for that call. We're just about out of time. A quick question about Lincoln's physical appearance. Did Lincoln have giantism?
No. He was 6'4", which is not even a small forward in the NBA today, but tall for his age, certainly, for his era. People have speculated that he may have had Marfan syndrome, which manifests itself in unusual height, or other genetic illnesses. We could never know unless we tested his DNA, which I don't think is an appropriate thing to do. But no, we can't know that unless we test him. But he was not bizarrely tall. He was simply taller than most people.
Well, and the stovepipe hat didn't hurt either.
Didn't diminish it, just did it? No.
Added another. I don't know how tall were those things. I mean, they were huge.
They were. I've seen one of them in Springfield recently. That was just donated this past year to the museum in Springfield, Illinois. And I would estimate it at 12 inches, perhaps, in height, just in my mind's eye.
Right up there with the beehive hairdo.
That's right.
We're just about out of time. I don't really want to take another call. I just wanted to ask you about the book itself. Is there a website associated with this book of any kind that we could mention, or a place where people could look for it?
The usual outlets, the bookstores, the online places like Amazon certainly have it. You can hear me talk more about it at worldtalkradio.com, where I present a show called Civil War Talk Radio, an online presentation much like the one we've had here. But I don't talk about my book every week. We have other Civil War and Lincoln authors on.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for an enjoyable hour. We could talk about Lincoln for a long time, and certainly we would never. It would take hours and hours and hours to get through everything in this book. But thank you for giving us the taste of it that you did today.
John, thank you for having me on.
Jerry Prokopovich, author of the book Did Lincoln Own Slaves and Other Frequently Asked Questions About Abraham Lincoln. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.